day Clarence Pickett died, Wilma Jones's hog, Francis, stopped talking. Now, of course, no one else had ever heard the swine utter word the first, but Wilma swore up and down that the creature had said to her, "Jesus wept," on a sunny day in June.
Hogs That Talk and Pigs That Fly, new fiction from the South, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with two writers, Randall Keenan and John Welter. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. You can depend upon Southern writers to come up with quirky themes and memorable characters. The tradition continues with Randall Keenan, a native of Chincapin, North Carolina, who now teaches at Sarah Lawrence College and Columbia University. His new collection of stories is Let the Dead Bury Their Dead. In the hamlet of Timms Creek, North Carolina, Keenan creates the fantastic, the tragic, and the comic. Timms Creek has its origins in a maroon society of runaway slaves whose lives reverberate through Keenan's combination of scholarship, oral history, and imagination. I asked Randall Keenan to read from his new book.
On the day Clarence Pickett died, Wilma Jones's hog, Francis, stopped talking. Now, of course, no one else had ever heard the swine utter word the first, but Wilma swore up and down that the creature had said to her, "Jesus wept," on a sunny day in June. But the peculiar thing was that Wilma had not known of Clarence's death when she declared the hog's final hushing up. And oddly enough, it was on the exact day of Clarence's birth, 5 years before, that Wilma had commenced preaching that the hog could talk.
Well, I tell you, I have read about some strange animals in fiction, but this one really begins to take the cake, Randall Keenan.
Thank you.
This story is called Clarence and the Dead. And what do they tell you, Clarence? And the dead speak to Clarence. Who is Clarence Pickett?
Clarence Pickett is this young boy who, at the age of 3, starts talking in complete sentences, and not only that, but starts giving revelations from dead folk.
Is he a prophet?
I wouldn't quite call him a prophet. I mean, closer to a medium. He's not, well, you're never quite sure if he's aware of exactly the importance of what he's talking about.
He certainly scares the adults around him,
oh,
doesn't he?
Oh, this is true.
Why is this? What does he do?
Well, it's really because of what he has to say. I mean, the messages he's sending from the grave that tend to upset people. There are a lot of secrets revealed.
He walks into a room and says, "We know that your husband is carrying on with that strumpet Violet, and you better look out." And what do the grown-ups do?
Oh, they whip him, basically.
Now, we're laughing at Clarence a little bit here, Randall Keenan, but there's also a very serious, sad dimension to this little boy's life. He dies even before he begins kindergarten. What happens to him?
Well, he picks up pneumonia, or so they think. He also has a strange relationship, I guess you would say, with a man whose wife has died, and the wife communicates through the boy with the man.
Where does Timms Creek come from?
Well, Timms Creek was really born in the novel, and in truth, it sort of grew out of the characters. I mean, I knew the characters very, very well. And as Eudora Welty says, place grows out of character, and character partakes of history, and so on and so on.
Were these people that you knew as a kid growing up in eastern North Carolina?
Well, let's say they were influenced by people I knew as a kid growing up in eastern North Carolina.
Uh-huh. When you write stories such as you have in Let the Dead Bury Their Dead, Randall Keenan, are you reflecting really on what's back there in history, or are you telling us about ourselves today?
I'm really telling us, well, I'm telling you about both.
Uh-huh.
I mean, questioning the people back then, and also questioning ourselves.
Tell me about the foundations of the earth. Here we have Mrs. Maggie McGowan Williams. She's a successful entrepreneur in and about Timms Creek, North Carolina. And what happens to her?
Well, mysteriously, her grandson, who is somewhat estranged, dies.
Edward,
exactly. And along with his body being returned to Timms Creek comes his gay lover.
Uh-huh.
And she is sort of overcome with all sorts of questions.
Yeah, now this is not something that would have been a stock sort of a situation in Southern fiction 20, 30, 40 years ago.
To be sure.
What are you doing with it today? Are you rattling the cage?
Well, I should like to hope so. I mean, I like putting these extreme opposites. People in American society, we don't like to think of at the same time. And force them together and see what kind of sparks fly out of it.
Is this a plea for toleration? Why do you put such an apparently outrageous situation into the lives of conventional Southern black people?
Well, I wouldn't call it tolerance. More understanding, broadening. And also, there is an assumption with people from certain parts of the universe, particularly southeastern North Carolina, that they're limited in a ways. And I don't believe that human beings are really limited. I think that they can expand in ways we don't even realize.
Does this sort of a situation grow out of the fact, Randall Keenan, that you grew up in eastern North Carolina and then left it and had to go away and learn lessons before you could bring them back home?
Well, to be sure, many of the lessons were already there. I grew up with them. I just didn't know it. It took going away to make me understand more clearly.
Here's another sort of typical situation in a story you have called The Origin of Wales. It's a babysitting story. very, very placid on its surface. You have Aunt Essie looking after little Thad, who's a sort of a wiseacre and a rebel. And yet this kid is learning at the feet and the hands of this old woman. What goes on?
Well, they just have this relationship. You see the sort of superficial authoritarian power she has over him is really born out of love and this unique understanding that only exists between the very old and the very young.
She loses a friend, and little Thad comes out to... Does he console her? Is that what's going on at the end of the story, when she wants this moment alone before she goes back in to help him with his homework?
Well, I mean, that moment, which is very difficult for me to try to capture, is a moment in which people reflect on their own mortality, in which the very young, particularly in the rural areas of this country, come in contact with death in a very visceral, real way that, you know, isn't filtered through the television or the newspapers.
Well, indeed, that is a theme that runs all through this collection. You begin with a little passage from Catherine Ann Porter about Pale Horse, Pale Rider, death. Right. Is this a morbid book? After all, are you trying to make us think about dying, or are we laughing at ourselves? What's the interplay here?
Well, no, that's exactly why I chose that particular passage from Catherine Ann Porter, who is one of my favorite writers and who I would one day hope to be able to emulate to some degree. But because that passage is about someone who's at death's door and whose desire to live, this abstraction is made very intensely real.
And the living is in much of the laughter in this story.
Exactly.
Because you run between these furious counterpoints between the hysterically funny and the deeply depressing sort of thing that you're doing here. Trying to make us manic?
Well, I think life is manic in that fashion. You do go from great peaks to depressing troughs.
The next story in your collection is This Far or A Body in Motion. Here's a wonderful sort of historical romance. You are doing something with the life of Booker T. Washington.
Just before he dies.
Tell me.
In 1915, he comes to Thames Creek at the behest of these two beguiling twins he knew while he was going to school at Hampton Institute.
The McIlwains.
Exactly, exactly.
And what happens to him when he comes back and has this reunion with these two?
Well, it's sort of, when you hear often about people just before they're beginning to die, having these sort of amazing summing ups. Having these coincidences from the past to sort of hit them. And I thought this would be an interesting time because there were so many things that Booker T. Washington would have been facing just before he died. This would be a wonderful way for him to confront them, or for them to confront him.
He sees himself as, imposter is a little too strong, but he sees in himself, because of these two characters, the weaknesses, the roads not taken, the things that he might have, could have done. Are you questioning our notion of this great figure back there on our American historical horizon?
Well, I've always been fascinated, almost obsessed with Washington. I mean, all the documentation shows that there are tremendous contradictions. He was exceedingly powerful. He worked for tremendous causes, but at the same time, he used exceedingly Machiavellian schemes to bring them about. And so between the two poles, I think the man, the real person, existed. And I want to try to...
You don't want to destroy the man, but you want to question the stereotypes.
Well, yes. I mean, because he couldn't be one or the other. He has to be something in between.
You're going to have to help me with the title of the next story. Ragnarok?
Ragnarok, yes.
Ragnarok, the day the gods... Tell me, what does this word mean?
It's from the Old Norse. In Old Norse mythology, it was the end of the world. It's what our Armageddon comes from, really.
Well, now here we have the Reverend Barden, who presides, as it were, over Tim's Creek, and he's preaching at the funeral of his lover, Louise. This is a very well-kept secret, I take it.
Well, he wants to think so. We never really get an outside view, but in these sorts of communities, I don't know how well you can keep secrets like that.
Is this a story about hypocrisy or compassion? How do you feel about these characters?
It's about both. I mean, I don't really believe. I think the only person you can be hypocritical with is yourself. So on that level, it's about him confronting his own hypocrisy.
Does he find peace? Does he find serenity and purity? He certainly longs for it.
I think that's what it's about, him longing for it. And as to whether he will ever come about it, I mean, that's an unanswerable question, only so that he could answer.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Tell Me, Tell Me. This is a bleak story of racism in and about your fictional town of Tim's Creek. Ida Perry is your character. She dreams of seeing a young black boy. She runs over him on the highway. Really, what she's doing is remembering something awful. Tell me what you can without spoiling the story.
Difficult, and it's built upon itself. So, Ida keeps having visions, as you say, of this little colored boy, and a lot of it is the story takes place during this conversation with her good friend. And increasingly, she begins to see the boy more and more, and ultimately the boy shows up in her house. She never, in the story, realizes who the boy was, but the reader is made privy to the incident where she really first encountered the boy.
She's remembering her husband, whose nickname is Butch. He turns out to be a very successful lawyer, and yet he has a deep secret in his past, just as she does. Is this an individual statement, Randall, or are you indicting the white race, period?
Oh, far from it, far from it. The story is really about memory. It's about how we close off. Mm-hmm. So, and the world has changed, and part of the reason that these demons are coming up in her head is because she's sort of encountering these changes. She meets this young black minister. Her son, who is a doctor, sends her to a doctor who happens to be black. Mm-hmm. She's confronted with the way things are changing and wants to accept them. But these things in her past, which she won't accept, makes it difficult for her.
Let's spend a few minutes here and talk about your title story. We're saving this for last because it comes last in the collection. A marvelous bringing together of history, mythology, genealogy, scholarship, personal recollection. Let me read the whole title here. Let the Dead Bury Their Dead, being the annotated oral history of the former Maroon Society called Snatchit, and then Tearshirt, and later the town of Tim's Creek, North Carolina, 1854 to 1985. How long did you brood over that title?
Quite as long, almost as long as it took me to write the story, I should think.
What came first, the historical impulse, the personal memories? It all revolves here around a recollection in script, as it were, of a conversation between the Reverend James Malachi Green and his great-uncle and great-aunt, and they're looking back to the origins of Tim's Creek.
Exactly. Well, as far as origins for me, it was really quite simultaneous, which is really odd, but also that's expressed, I think, in the fact that the book really, I mean, the story really has about five or six narrators who are all telling their own story about the same thing. And that is really how it came to me. It was at once very personal, very historical, very scientific, and very, you know, intellectual in the critical sense.
One of the central characters is a man, a demigod. What do we call him? The Pharaoh.
Well, to me, he's archetypical of that genius which is within all of Black Americans, in a sense. I mean, he's emblematic of the ingenuity that allowed them to survive. When I first heard about Maroon societies, which was something very, very foreign to me, I was just astounded and enchanted that such things existed. They aren't in the history books.
Uh-huh.
So he was at once he embodied what allowed these things to exist, with a little fancy thrown in for good measure, but also, you know, sort of a commenter from the past on what we've done with that ingenuity.
Randall Keenan, let's conclude our conversation about your wonderful collection of stories here. Read Thank to you. Me, please, from your final story, Let the Dead Bury Their Dead.
You remember you saw your first snake in her garden when you were three. She was babysitting you. You were playing in the cabbage row, and she kept calling to you to come here, boy, come here, from where she picked beans, putting them in her apron. You got on your knees and saw a long, pretty, shiny stick, and you touched it soft. And it moved, undulating beneath your touch, and then the head presented itself in anger, and you ran, ran, ran. You didn't even know what to call it when she asked you what the matter was. You just cried. She laughed and pulled you to her. Silly child. She dipped snuff in those days, and you could smell the stale, sweetly sharp smell of the ground dust. And when you stopped crying, she said, "Now get on up from here. I got work to do." There was always work to do. Work to do. Work to do. Wasn't there?
Randall Keenan, this is great stuff. I want to thank you for coming by the National Humanities Center. You just read us a passage here from the title story, Let the Dead Bury Their Dead. Harcourt Brace Jovanovich, I congratulate you on your work, and I wish you well. And just very quickly, tell me, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a travel book about African America.
All right, we'll look forward to that. Randall Keenan, thanks for your contribution to Soundings.
Thank you.
It's Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. New fiction from the South. Join me now for a conversation with John Welter, whose first novel was published last spring by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. The book is Begin to Exit Here, and it's subtitled A Novel of the Wayward Press. John Welter fills his novel with episodes of folly and affection, reflecting the contradictions of journalism, local politics, bittersweet love, and the reversals of life in a university town, all gathered in the narrative voice of Welter's main character, who's in trouble just about all the time with everybody. I asked John Welter to read from his new book.
Less than 2 weeks after being fired for who I was hired for who I was. The world had no interest in making sense. That was one reason we had newspapers, to take the ordinary chaos and complexity of daily life, rob it of nearly all emotion and wonder, then arbitrarily force sense onto the world. Again, I was going to be an important ally and enemy of the newspapers, which I gleefully expressed that evening during a champagne toast to me and my new job, and I wanted to drink.
John, your novel is Begin to Exit Here. You got a lot of mean things to say about newspapers and reporters here. Are you carrying a grudge around? What?
Well, I put the grudge in the book. I don't have it with me anymore.
Does this come directly out of your experience? Is this John Welter talking to us in the form of Kurt Clausen?
The character Kurt is quite a bit similar to me. In the most general or abstract sense, it is an autobiographical novel, although the majority of the events in the book didn't happen. I made those up to avoid libel.
We don't want to overlook your imagination at work,
no.
Do we? Let's rehearse some of these events in Begin to Exit Here. How about the title? Where'd that come from?
The title came toward the end of the writing of the novel, and a friend and I, a good friend of mine, were driving to Washington and trying to figure out what to call the book, and I had not thought of it and had no interest in it. And as we were driving on the highway, she saw an exit sign in Virginia that said Begin to Exit Here and suggested I call it that. And we decided it was a good title.
All right, let's step back from the title and talk about what goes on in the book. We have a character named Kurt Clausen. He's in love with a young woman named Janice. He's a reporter. He loses a job, he gains a job, and he works in a town called Saint Beaujolais. Sounds suspiciously like Chapel Hill, North Carolina. How about this, John?
Well, actually, when I started writing the book, I set the novel in Chapel Hill in Carrboro, and by the time I was done with it, my editor, Louis Rubin, suggested that the book could be offensive enough to a certain number of people that they might desperately try to find themselves in the story and didn't contact a lawyer. Uh-huh. So he recommended changing the names of the town, and so I did.
Uh-huh. Sort of like what Thomas Wolfe went through. You have got a wonderful assortment of people in this novel, John Welter. You have a gay police chief, for example. Tell me how that episode evolved.
That, well, As I was writing the book, I write without any plan or outline. I just invent things as I go along. And at a certain point, when I wanted something new to happen, I, for some reason, spontaneously came up with a news story that would involve a gay police chief, just because I'd never heard of one before.
And are you trying to pique the public sensibility here? Are you ridiculing our, what, purported liberalism? What's at work here?
In a way, I am doing that, because in the setting of the novel, the people it's a university town, and the people regard themselves as enlightened liberals naturally. But part of the point of writing about the gay police chief was to show that enlightened liberals aren't necessarily enlightened or liberal at sometimes. There's a certain traditionalism or orthodoxy or bias or bigotry that remains in people, and it will show up at any point.
What about on a little bit lighter note here in your novel, Begin to Exit Here? You got a couple of flying pigs. The reporter, Kurt Clausen, reports on a tornado, and nobody's killed.
They didn't fly very long.
That's right, but a pig flies through the air and ends up in a tree. This is the strangeness of the world that newspaper reporters have to deal with, right?
Well, it is. It might not seem like ordinary reality, but in fact it is. I'm from the Midwest, where we have a lot of tornadoes, and it's sort of routine in the spring and summer, so that's why I put a tornado in the book. It had nothing to do with The Wizard of Oz. But when tornadoes come, they do strange things, and one is to, say, lift a 200 or 300-pound pig into a tree, which is...
You've also got an episode where your main character is driving home after a relatively boring town council meeting, and a shopping center blows up, and wham, through the window, here comes another form of a flying pig. It's a canned ham. What's going on there?
I think I was hungry when I was writing that part of the book. I just wanted to be sort of deliberately bizarre, but in a slightly believable way. If a shopping center blew up, and including a grocery store, all kinds of debris would come out at a pretty strong force. Uh-huh. And I just wanted this ham to hit the car.
Is this novel, John, basically cynical or comical in the way you portray this character, who is a reporter who has to deal with the world as well as himself, talk to other people about the world?
Well, it's probably a little bit cynical, but I meant for it to be primarily comical. I don't have, when I was writing, inventing the character, it probably parallels me so much that if I'm cynical, then the character will be cynical.
Uh-huh. You had any particular models in mind as you created this Kurt Clausen character?
Not really, not at all. I was as I went along, I made up his emotions and behaviors.
Uh-huh. Now, he loves baseball. Baseball is an element in this book. Do we have a lot of... somebody might accuse you of some heavy-handed symbolism here. What about it?
What would the symbolism be?
I don't know.
It myself.
My goodness. I mean, you know, baseball is the paradigm of American culture. You want to affirm that, or you want to deny that?
I'll deny it. I can't even spell paradigm.
What about cynicism, period? Are you indicting the press in this novel? You really do have some mean things to say about the way reporters tell us about the world around us.
Oh, it's not mean. It's rationally harsh. I do have some strong criticisms to make, and it's not of journalism per se, but of the regimented and highly restricted nature of the way it's taught and practiced. Since I've worked in so many newspapers, I know how that's done.
Well, I'm going to flip through the pages here until I find your chart. You call it the forbidden... What is the exact wording here? The forbidden chart?
Forbidden chart of American journalism.
All right, and what is in this chart? There it is. Describe that for our listeners. Paint us a little picture.
Well, it's meant to be, it's just a crude sketch, deliberately crude, and it's meant to show the fact that newspaper editors and reporters think everything they do, or nearly everything they do, is of tremendous importance and interest to the reading public, when in fact most of it isn't interesting to them at all.
Yeah, it's a square, and on one side we got an arrow pointing, and it says what newspapers routinely write about, and on the other side an arrow pointing, and it says what readers care about. Down in the bottom, a tiny little section, extra stuff we write about because an editor says so, and then the kicker, a dot. In the lower right-hand corner, volume of readers who remember what we wrote one day later.
Well, I think that's probably pretty true. I mean, you can do as many surveys as you want, and I think they'll probably fairly closely match up to that, which I did mostly as a joke.
Let's end on something of a sober note, John Welter. How do you think of yourself as having a responsibility or not having a responsibility as a writer? I mean, you produce these books, they get out, and they circulate. Are you concerned about the effect that they have? Are you communicating a message? What?
Yeah, I would hope that people would take the book seriously, period. I don't write just art for art's sake. I don't care for that and don't believe in it. What I would hope to do is write something, and I hope I've achieved it in this book, that describes the way people really feel, what their lives are really like, period, in the most general sense. I don't have any moral venture involved in that. But I do take it seriously. I don't think it's just art. I don't think it's supposed to be just funny, and then I hope people buy it so I'll make money. You know, I'd like to make money, of course. But I'm at least a little bit of a moral writer. I do care about the characters, and I hope somehow, even if the people who read the book only see humor in it and nothing else, they've at least done that.
A quick footnote to our conversation, John. Do you have one particular writer that you go back to and draw upon for inspiration, or that you think of as a model?
No, I used to, but I gave that up. I've been...
Who was it?
Well, it was more than one. It was Mark Twain and H.L. Mencken and S.J. Perlman, a lot of humorists.
Right.
But there was a point at which you have to stop imitating other writers and just write like yourself, and I started doing that, I hope, a long time ago.
Well, I want to congratulate you on your novel. You got a terrific book here. It's called Begin to Exit Here. The subtitle is A Novel of the Wayward Press. I love that. Published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. John Welter, thanks for coming by the National Humanities Center. Good luck in your work.
Thank you very much.
It's Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to conversations with Randall Keenan and John Welter. Randall Keenan's new collection of stories, Let the Dead Bury Their Dead, was recently published by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. John Welter's first novel, Begin to Exit Here, was published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Cassette copies of this program are available for $5. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. The program number this week is 623. That's number 623, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a summary of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, Sylvia Tomash of Hunter College will talk about maps and the medieval geographic imagination. Sara Suleri of Yale University will talk about her new book, The Rhetoric of English India. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Talking Hogs and Flying Pigs, new fiction from the South, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Randall Keenan discusses his new collection of stories, Let the Dead Bury Their Dead. John Welter talks about his first novel, Begin to Exit Here. New fiction from the South, this week on Soundings.